Laughing Lord, Sea Demon, Horned Honor, Ragged Jenna, Trident Three, Swift Sword, Princess Rhaenys, Dog's Nose, Scepter, Faithful, Red Raven, Queen Alysanne, Cat, Courageous, and Dragonsbane. From every stern stream the fiery heart of the Lord of Light, red and yellow and orange. Behind Davos and his sons came another line of hundreds, commanded by knights and lordly captains, and then the smaller, slower, Moorish contingent, none dipping more than 80 oars. Farther back would come the sailed ships, carracks, and lumbering great cogs. And last of all, Salador San in his proud Valyrian, a towering 300, paced by the rest of his galleys with their distinctive striped hulls. The flamboyant Lysenny princeling had not been pleased to be assigned the rear guard, but it was clear that Sir Imri trusted him no more than Stannis did. Too many complaints, and too much talk of the gold he was owed. Davos was sorry nonetheless. Salador San was a resourceful old pirate, and his crews were born seamen, fearless in a fight. They were wasted in the rear. Ahoo! The call rolled across white caps and churning oars from the forecastle of the Fury. Sir Imri was sounding the attack. Ahoo! Ahoo! Swordfish had joined the line at last, though she still had her sail raised. Fast, crews! Davos barked. The drum began to beat more quickly, and the stroke picked up, the blades of the oars cutting water. Splash, swoosh, splash, swoosh, splash, swoosh. On deck, soldiers banged sword against shield, while archers quietly strung their bows and pulled the first arrow from the quivers at their belts. The galleys of the first line of battle obscured his vision, so Davos paced the deck, searching for a better view. He saw no sign of any boom. The mouth of the river was open, as if to swallow them all, except... In his smuggling days, Davos had often jested that he knew the waterfront at King's Landing a deal better than the back of his hand, since he had not spent a good part of his life sneaking in and out of the back of his hand. The squat towers of raw new stone that stood opposite one another at the mouth of the Blackwater might mean nothing to Sir Imri Florent, but to him it was as if two extra fingers had sprouted from his knuckles. Shading his eyes against the westering sun, he peered at those towers more closely. They were too small to hold much of a garrison. The one on the north bank was built against the bluff, with the red keep frowning above. Its counterpart on the south shore had its footing in the water. They dug a cut through the bank, he knew at once. That would make the tower very difficult to assault. Attackers would need to wade through the water or bridge the little channel. Stannis had posted bowmen below to fire up at the defenders whenever one was rash enough to lift his head above the ramparts, but otherwise had not troubled. Something flashed down low, where the dark water swirled around the base of the tower. It was sunlight on steel, and it told Davos Seaworth all he needed to know. A chain boom. And yet they have not closed the river against us. Why? He could make a guess at that as well, but there was no time to consider the question. A shout went up from the ships ahead, and the war horns blew again. The enemy was before them. Between the flashing oars of Scepter and Faithful, Davos saw a thin line of galleys drawn across the river, the sun glinting off the gold paint that marked their hulls. He knew those ships as well as he knew his own. When he had been a smuggler, he always felt safer knowing whether the sail on the horizon marked a fast ship or a slow one, and whether her captain was a young man hungry for glory or an old one serving out his days. Ahoo! The war horns called. Battle speed! Davos shouted. On port and starboard, he heard Dale and Allard giving the same command. Drums began to beat furiously. Oars rose and fell, and Black Betha surged forward. When he glanced towards Wraith, Dale gave him a salute. Swordfish was lagging once more, wallowing in the wake of the smaller ships to either side. Elsewise, the line was straight as a shield wall. The river that had seemed so narrow from a distance now stretched wide as a sea, but the city had grown gigantic as well. Glaring down from Aegon's high hill, the Red Keep commanded the approaches. Its iron-crowned battlements, massive towers, and thick red walls gave it the aspect of a ferocious beast hunched above the river and streets. The bluffs on which it crouched were steep and rocky, spotted with lichen and gnarled thorny trees. The fleet would have to pass below the castle to reach the harbour and city beyond. The first line was in the river now, but the enemy galleys were backing water.
"They mean to draw us in. They want us jammed close, constricted. No way to sweep round their flanks. And with that boom behind us..."
He paced his deck, craning his neck for a better look at Joffrey's fleet. The boy's toys included the ponderous God's Grace he saw, the old slow Prince Aemon, the Lady of Silk and her sister, Lady Shame, Wildwind, Kingslander, Whiteheart, Lance, Seaflower. But where was the Lion Star? Where was the beautiful Lady Lyanna that King Robert had named in honor of the maid he loved and lost? And where was King Robert's Hammer? She was the largest war galley in the Royal Fleet, 400 oars, the only warship the boy king owned capable of overmatching fury. By rights, she should have formed the heart of any defense. Davos tasted a trap, yet he saw no sign of any foes sweeping in behind them. Only the great fleet of Stannis Baratheon in their ordered ranks, stretching back to the watery horizon.
"Will they raise the chain and cut us in two?"
He could not see what good that would serve. The ships left out in the bay could still land men north of the city. A slower crossing, but safer. A flight of flickering orange birds took wing from the castle, 20 or 30 of them. Pots of burning pitch, arcing out over the river, trailing threads of flame. The waters ate most, but a few found the decks of galleys in the first line of battle, spreading flame where they shattered. Men-at-arms were scrambling on Queen Alysanne's deck, and he could see smoke rising from three different spots on Dragonsbane nearest the bank. By then, a second flight was on its way, and arrows were falling as well, hissing down from the archers' nests that studded the towers above. A soldier tumbled over the cat's gunwale, crashed off the oars, and sank.
"The first man to die today," Davos thought, "but he will not be the last."
Atop the Red Keep's battlements streamed the boy king's banners, the crown stag of Baratheon on its gold field, the line of Lannister on crimson. More pots of pitch came flying. Davos heard men shriek as fire spread across Courageous. Her oarsmen were safe below, protected from missiles by the half-deck that sheltered them, but the men-at-arms, crowded topside, were not so fortunate. The starboard wing was taking all the damage, as he had feared.
"It'll be our turn soon," he reminded himself, uneasy.
Black Betha was well in range of the firepots, being the sixth ship out from the north bank. To starboard, she had only Allard's Lady Maria, the ungainly Swordfish, so far behind now that she was nearer the third line than the second, and Piety, Prayer, and Devotion, who would need all the godly intervention they could get, placed as vulnerably as they were. As the second line swept past the twin towers, Davos took a closer look. He could see three links of a huge chain snaking out from a hole no bigger than a man's head and disappearing under the water. The towers had a single door, set a good 20 feet off the ground. Bowmen on the roof of the northern tower were firing down at Prayer and Devotion. The archers on Devotion fired back, and Davos heard a man scream as the arrows found him.
"Captain, sir."
His son Mathis was at his elbow. "Your helm." Davos took it with both hands and slid it over his head. The butt helm was visorless. He hated having his vision impeded. By then, the pitch pots were raining down around them. He saw one shatter on the deck of Lady Maria, but Allard's crew quickly beat it out. To port, war horns sounded from the Pride of Driftmark. The oars flung up sprays of water with every stroke. The yard-long shaft of a scorpion came down not 2 feet from Mathis and sank into the wood of the deck, thrumming. Ahead, the first line was within bowshot of the enemy. Flights of arrows flew between ships, hissing like striking snakes. South of the Blackwater, Davos saw men dragging crude rafts toward the water, while ranks and columns formed up beneath 1,000 streaming banners. Their fiery heart was everywhere, though the tiny black stag imprisoned in the flames was too small to make out.
"We should be flying the crown stag," he thought. "The stag was King Robert's sigil. The city would rejoice to see it. This stranger's standard serves only to set men against us."
He could not behold the fiery heart without thinking of the shadow Melisandre had burst in the gloom beneath Storm's End.
"At least we fight this battle in the light, with the weapons of honest men," he told himself.
The Red Woman and her dark children would have no part of it. Stannis had shipped her back to Dragonstone with his bastard nephew, Edric Storm. His captains and bannermen had insisted that a battlefield was no place for a woman. Only the Queen's men had dissented, and then not loudly. All the same, the King had been on the point of refusing them until Lord Bryce Caron said, "Your Grace, if the sorceress is with us, afterward men will say it was her victory, not yours. They will say you owe your crown to her spells." That turned the tide. Davos himself had held his tongue during the arguments, but if truth be told, he had not been sad to see the back of her. He wanted no part of Melisandre or her guard. To starboard, Devotion drove toward shore, sliding out a plank. Archers scrambled into the shallows, holding their bows high above their heads to keep the strings dry. They splashed ashore on the narrow strand beneath the bluffs. Rocks came bouncing down from the castle to crash among them, and arrows and spears as well. But the angle was steep, and the missiles seemed to do little damage. Prayer landed 2 dozen yards upstream, and Piety was slanting towards the bank when the defenders came pounding down the riverside, the hooves of their war horses sending up gouts of water from the shallows. The knights fell among the archers like wolves among chickens, driving them back toward the ships and into the river before most could notch an arrow. Men-at-arms rushed to defend them with spear and axe, and in 3 heartbeats the scene had turned to blood-soaked chaos. Davos recognized the dog's head helm of the Hound. A white cloak streamed from his shoulders as he rode his horse up the plank onto the deck of Prayer, hacking down anyone who blundered within reach. Beyond the castle, King's Landing rose on its hills behind the encircling walls. The riverfront was a blackened desolation. The Lannisters had burned everything and pulled back within the mud gate. The charred spars of sunken hulks sat in the shallows, forbidding access to the long stone quays.
"We shall have no landing there."
He could see the tops of 3 huge trebuchets behind the mud gate. High on Visenya's hill, sunlight blazed off the 7 crystal towers of the great Sept of Baelor. Davos never saw a battle joined, but he heard it. A great rending crash as 2 galleys came together. He could not say which 2. Another impact echoed over the water an instant later, and then a 3rd. Beneath the screech of splintering wood, he heard the deep thrum-thump of the Fury's 4 catapult. Stag of the Sea split one of Joffrey's galleys clean in half, but Dog's Nose was afire, and Queen Alysanne was locked between Lady of Silk and Lady's Shame, her crew fighting the borders rail to rail. Directly ahead, Davos saw the enemy's Kingslander drive between Faithful and Scepter. The former slid her starboard oars out of the way before impact, but Scepter's portside oar snapped like so much kindling as Kingslander raked along her side. "Loose!" Davos commanded, and his bowmen sent a withering rain of shafts across the water. He saw Kingslander's captain fall and tried to recall the man's name. Ashore, the arms of the great trebuchets rose 1, 2, 3, and 100 stones climbed high into the yellow sky. Each one was as large as a man's head. When they fell, they sent up great gouts of water, smashed through oak planking, and turned living men into bone and pulp and grizzle. All across the river, the first line was engaged. Grappling hooks were flung out. Iron rams crashed through wooden hulls. Boarders swarmed. Flights of arrows whispered through each other in the drifting smoke, and men died. But so far, none of his. Black Betha swept upriver, the sound of her oarmaster's drum thundering in her captain's head as he looked for a likely victim for her ram. The beleaguered Queen Alisande was trapped between two Lannister warships, the three made fast by hooks and lines. "Ram in speed!" Davos shouted. The drum beats blurred into a long, fevered hammering, and Black Betha flew, the water turning white as milk as it parted for her prow. Allard had seen the same chance. Lady Maria ran beside them. The first line had been transformed into a confusion of separate struggles. The three Tangle ships loomed ahead, turning. Their decks a red chaos as men hacked at each other with sword and axe.
"A little more," Davos Seaworth beseeched the warrior. "Bring around a little more. Show me your broadside."
The warrior must have been listening. Black Betha and Lady Maria slammed into the side of Lady Shame within an instant of each other, ramming her fore and aft with such force that men were thrown off the deck of Lady of Silk 3 boats away. Davos almost bit his tongue off when his teeth jarred together. He spat out blood.
"Next time, close your mouth, you fool."
40 years at sea, and yet this was the first time he'd rammed another ship. His archers were loosing arrows at will.
"Backwater,"
he commanded. When Black Betha reversed her oars, the river rushed into the splintered hole she left, and Lady Shame fell to pieces before his eyes, spilling dozens of men into the river. Some of the living swam, some of the dead floated, the ones in heavy mail and plate sank to the bottom, the quick and the dead alike. The pleas of drowning men echoed in his ears. A flash of green caught his eye, ahead and off to port, and a nest of writhing emerald serpents rose burning and hissing from the stern of Queen Alisande. An instant later, Davos heard the dread cry of "Wildfire!" He grimaced. Burning pitch was one thing, wildfire quite another. Evil stuff, and well nigh unquenchable. Smother it under a cloak, and the cloak took fire. Slap at a fleck of it with your palm, and your hand was aflame. "Piss on wildfire, and your cock burns off," old seamen liked to say. Still, Sir Emery had warned them to expect a taste of the alchemist's vile substance. Fortunately, there were few true pyromancers left. "They will soon run out," Sir Emery had assured them. Davos reeled off commands. One bank of oars pushed off, while the other backed water, and the galley came about. Lady Maria had one clear, too, and a good thing. The fire was spreading over Queen Alisande and her foes faster than he would have believed possible. Men wreathed in green flame leapt into the water, shrieking like nothing human. On the walls of King's Landing, spitfires were belching death, and the great trebuchets behind the mud gate were throwing boulders. One the size of an ox crashed down between Black Betha and Wraith, rocking both ships and soaking every man on deck. Another, not much smaller, found bold laughter. The Valerian galley exploded like a child's toy dropped from a tower, spraying splinters as long as a man's arm. Through black smoke and swirling green fire, Davos glimpsed a swarm of small boats bearing downriver, a confusion of ferries and wherries, barges, skiffs, rowboats and hulks that looked too rotten to float.
It stank of desperation. Such driftwood could not turn the tide of a fight, only get in the way. The lines of battle were hopelessly ensnarled, he saw. Off to port, Lord Stephen, Ragged Jenner, and Swift Sword had broken through and were sweeping upriver. The starboard wing was heavily engaged, however, and the centre had shattered onto the stones of those trebuchets, some captains turning downstream, others veering to board, anything to escape that crushing rain. Fury had swung her aft catapult to fire back at the city, but she lacked the range. The barrels of pitch were shattering under the walls. Scepter had lost most of her oars, and Faithful had been rammed and was starting to list. He took Black Betha between them and struck a glancing blow at Queen Circe's ornate carved and gilded pleasure barge, laden with soldiers instead of sweetmeats now. The collision spilled a dozen of them into the river, where Betha's archers picked them off as they tried to stay afloat. Mather's shout alerted him to the danger from port. One of the Lannister galleys was coming about to ram. "Hard to starboard!" Davis shouted. His men used their oars to push free of the barge, while others turned the galley so her prow faced the onrushing White Hart. For a moment he feared he'd been too slow, that he was about to be sunk. But the current helped to swing Black Betha, and when the impact came, it was only a glancing blow. The two hulls scraping against each other, both ships snapping oars. A jagged piece of wood flew past his head, sharp as any spear. Davis flinched. "Board her!" he shouted. Grappling lines were flung. He drew his sword and led them over the rail himself. The crew of the White Hart met them at the rail, but Black Betha's men-at-arms swept over them in a screaming steel tide. Davis fought through the press, looking for the other captain, but the man was dead before he reached him. As he stood over the body, someone caught him from behind with an axe, but his helm turned the blow, and his skull was left ringing where it might have been split. Dazed, it was all he could do to roll. His attacker charged, screaming. Davis grasped his sword in both hands and drove it up, point first, into the man's belly. One of his crewmen pulled him back to his feet. "Captain, sir, the Hart is ours." It was true, Davis saw. Most of the enemy were dead, dying, or yielded. He took off his helm, wiped blood from his face, and made his way back to his own ship, trotting carefully on boards slimy with men's guts. Mathis lent him a hand to help him back over the rail. For those few instants, Black Betha and White Hart were the calm eye in the midst of the storm. Queen Adasan and Lady of Silk, still locked together, were a raging green inferno, drifting downriver and dragging pieces of Lady's shame. One of the Moorish galleys had slabbed into them and was now afar as well. Cat was taking on men from the fast-sinking Courageous. The captain of Dragonsbane had driven her between two quays, ripping out her bottom. Her crew poured ashore with the archers and men-at-arms to join the assault on the walls. Red Raven, rammed, was slowly listing. Stag of the Sea was fighting fires and boarders both, but the Fiery Heart had been raised over Joffrey's loyal man. Fury, her proud bow smashed in by a boulder, was engaged with God's grace. He saw Lord Valerian's Pride of Driftmark crash between two Lannister river runners, overturning one and lighting the other up with fire arrows. On the south bank, knights were leading their mounts aboard the cogs, and some of the smaller galleys were already making their way across, laden with men-at-arms. They had to thread cautiously between sinking ships and patches of drifting wildfire. The whole of King Stannis's fleet was in the river now, save for Salador Sarn's Lyseni. Soon enough they would control the Blackwater. "Sir Imran will have his victory," Davos thought, "and Stannis will bring his host across. But gods be good, the cost of this." "Captain, sir," Mathis touched his shoulder. It was Swordfish, her two banks of oars lifting and falling. She had never brought down her sails, and some burning pitch had caught in her rigging. The flames spread as Davis watched, creeping out over ropes and sails until she trailed ahead of yellow flame, her ungainly iron ram, fashioned after the likeness of the fish from which she took her name, part of the surface of the river before her. Directly ahead, drifting toward her and swinging around to present a tempting plump target, was one of the Lannister hulks, floating low in the water. Slow green blood was leaking out between her boards. When he saw that, Davos Seaworth's heart stopped beating.
No, he said. No, no!
Above the roar and crash of battle, no one heard him but Mathis. Certainly the captain of the Swordfish did not, intent as he was on finally spearing something with his ungainly fat sword. The Swordfish went to battle speed. Davos lifted his maimed hand to clutch at the leather pouch that held his finger bones. With a grinding, splintering, tearing crash, Swordfish split the rutted hulk asunder. She burst like an overripe fruit, but no fruit ever screamed that shattering wooden scream. From inside her, Davos saw green gushing from 1,000 broken jars, poison from the entrails of a dying beast, glistening, shining, spreading across the surface of the river.
Backwater! He roared. Away! Get us off her! Backwater! Backwater!
The grappling lines were cut, and Davos felt the deck move under his feet as Black Betha pushed free of White Hart. Her oars slid down into the water. Then he heard a short, sharp woof, as if someone had blown in his ear. Half a heartbeat later came the roar. The deck vanished beneath him, and black water smashed him across the face, filling his nose and mouth. He was choking, drowning. Unsure which way was up, Davos wrestled the river in blind panic until suddenly he broke the surface. He spat out water, sucked in air, grabbed hold of the nearest chunk of debris, and held on. Swordfish and the hulk were gone. Blackened bodies were floating downstream beside him, and choking men clinging to bits of smoking wood. 50 feet high, a swirling demon of green flame danced upon the river. It had 12 hands, in each a whip, and whatever they touched burst into fire. He saw Black Betha burning, and White Hart, and Loyal Man to either side. Piety, Cat, Courageous, Scepter, Red Raven, Harridan, Faithful, Fury, they had all gone up. King's Lander and God's Grace as well. The demon was eating his own. Lord Valerian's shining Pride of Driftmark was trying to turn, but the demon ran a lazy green finger across her silvery oars, and they flared up like so many tapers. For an instant, she seemed to be stroking the river with 2 banks of long, bright torches. The current had him in its teeth by then, spinning him around and around. He kicked to avoid a floating patch of wildfire.
My sons, Davos thought,
but there was no way to look for them amidst the roaring chaos. Another hulk, heavy with wildfire, went up behind him. The black water itself seemed to boil in its bed, and burning spars and burning men and pieces of broken ships filled the air.
I'm being swept out into the bay.
Wouldn't be as bad there. He ought to be able to make sure. He was a strong swimmer. Salador San's galleys would be out in the bay as well. Sir Imri had commanded them to stand off. And then the current turned him about again, and Davos saw what awaited him downstream.
The chain. God save us. They've raised the chain.
Where the river broadened out into Blackwater Bay, the boom stretched taut, a bare 2 or 3 feet above the water. Already 12 galleys had crashed into it, and the current was pushing others against them. Almost all were aflame, and the rest soon would be. Davos could make out the striped hulls of Salador San's ships beyond. But he knew he would never reach them. A wall of red-hot steel, blazing wood, and swirling green flame stretched before him. The mouth of the Blackwater Rush had turned into the mouth of hell.
Tyrion. Motionless as a gargoyle, Tyrion Lannister hunched on one knee atop a merlin. Beyond the Mudgate and the desolation that had once been the fish market and wharves, the river itself seemed to have taken fire. Half of Stannis' fleet was ablaze, along with most of Joffrey's. The kiss of wildfire turned proud ships into funeral pyres and men into living torches. The air was full of smoke and arrows and screams. Downstream, commoners and highborn captains alike could see the hot green death swirling toward their rafts and carracks and ferries, borne on the current of the Blackwater. The long white oars of the Moorish galleys flashed like the legs of maddened centipedes as they fought to come about, but it was no good. The centipedes had no place to run. A dozen great fires raged under the city walls, where casks of burning pitch had exploded. But the wildfire reduced them to no more than candles in a burning house, their orange and scarlet pennons fluttering insignificantly against the jade holocaust. The low clouds caught the color of the burning river and roofed the sky in shades of shifting green, eerily beautiful. A terrible beauty, like dragon fire. Tyrion wondered if Aegon the Conqueror had felt like this as he flew over his field of fire. The furnace wind lifted his crimson cloak and beat at his bare face, yet he could not turn away. He was dimly aware of the gold cloaks cheering from the hoardings. He had no voice to join them. It was a half victory. It will not be enough. He saw another of the hulks, his stuff full of King Aerys' fickle fruits, engulfed by the hungry flames. A fountain of burning jade rose from the river, the blast so bright he had to shield his eyes. Plumes of fire 30 and 40 feet high danced upon the waters, crackling and hissing. For a few moments they washed out the screams. There were hundreds in the water, drowning, or burning, or doing a little of both. "Do you hear them shrieking, Stannis? Do you see them burning? This is your work as much as mine." Somewhere in that seething mass of men, south of the Blackwater, Stannis was watching too, Tyrion knew. He never had his brother Robert's thirst for battle. He would command from the rear, from the reserve, much as Lord Tywin Lannister was wont to do. Like as not, he was sitting on a war horse right now, clad in bright armor, his crown upon his head. "A crown of red gold," Varys says. "Its points fashioned in the shape of flames." "My ships!" Joffrey's voice cracked as he shouted up from the wall walk, where he huddled with his guards behind the ramparts. The golden circlet of kingship adorned his battle helm. "My Kingslander's burning. Queen Cersei, loyal man, look, that sea flower there." He pointed with his new sword out where the green flames were licking at Seaflower's golden hull and creeping up her oars. Her captain had turned her upriver, but not quickly enough to evade the wildfire. She was doomed, Tyrion knew. There was no other way. If we had not come forth to meet them, Stannis would have sensed the trap. An arrow could be aimed, and a spear, even the stone from a catapult. But wildfire had a will of its own. Once loosed, it was beyond the control of mere men. "It could not be helped," he told his nephew. "Our fleet was doomed in any case." Even from atop the Merlon, he had been too short to see over the ramparts, so it had them boost him up. The flames and smoke and chaos of battle made it impossible for Tyrion to see what was happening downriver under the castle. But he had seen it 1,000 times in his mind's eye. Bronn would have whipped the oxen into motion the moment Stannis' flagship passed under the Red Keep. The chain was ponderous heavy, and the great winches turned but slowly, creaking and rumbling. The whole of the usurper's fleet
would have passed by the time the first glimmer of metal could be seen beneath the water. The lynx would emerge dripping wet, some glistening with mud, link by link by link, until the whole great chain stretched taut. King Stannis had rowed his fleet up the Blackwater, but he would not row out again. Even so, some were getting away. A river's current was a tricky thing, and the wildfire was not spreading as evenly as he had hoped. The main channel was all aflame, but a good many of the mermen had made for the south bank and looked to escape unscathed, and at least 8 ships had landed under the city walls. Landed or wrecked, but it comes to the same thing. They've put men ashore. Worse, a good part of the south wing of the enemy's first 2 battle lines had been well upstream of the Inferno when the hulks went up. Stannis would be left with 30 or 40 galleys, at a guess, more than enough to bring his whole host across, once they had regained their courage. That might take a bit of time. Even the bravest would be dismayed after watching 1,000 or so of his fellows consumed by wildfire. Halen said that sometimes the substance burned so hot that flesh melted like tallow. Yet even so, Tyrion had no illusions where his own men were concerned. If the battle looks to be going sour, they'll break, and they'll break bad. Jaslyn Bywater had warned him. So the only way to win was to make certain the battle stayed sweet start to finish. He could see dark shapes moving through the charred ruins of the riverfront wharfs. Time for another sortie, he thought. Men were never so vulnerable as when they first staggered ashore. He must not give the foe time to form up on the north bank. He scrambled down off the Merlin. Tell Lord Jaslyn we've got enemy on the river front, he said to one of the runners Bywater had assigned to him. To another he said, bring my compliments to Sir Arnold and ask him to swing the hawse 30 degrees west. The angle would allow them to throw further, if not as far out into the water. Mother promised I could have the hawse, Joffrey said. Tyrion was annoyed to see that the king had lifted the visor of his helm again. Doubtless the boy was cooking inside all that heavy steel, but the last thing he needed was some stray arrow punching through his nephew's eye. He clanged the visor shut. Keep that closed, Your Grace. Your sweet person is precious to us all. And you don't want to spoil that pretty face either. The hawse are yours. It was as good a time as any. Flinging more fire pots down onto burning ships seemed pointless. Joff had the antler men trussed up naked in the square below, antlers nailed to their heads. When they had been brought before the Iron Throne for justice, he had promised to send them to Stannis. A man was not as heavy as a boulder or a cask of burning pitch and could be thrown a deal farther. Some of the gold cloaks had been wagering on whether the traitors would fly all the way across the Blackwater. Be quick about it, Your Grace, he told Joffrey. We'll want the trebuchets throwing stones again soon enough. Even wildfire does not burn forever. Joffrey hurried off happy, escorted by Sir Meron. But Tyrion caught Sir Osmond by the wrist before he could follow. Whatever happens, keep him safe, and keep him there. Is that understood?
As you command, Sir Osmond smiled amiably.
Tyrion had warned Trant and Kettleblack what would happen to them should any harm come to the king, and Joffrey had a dozen veteran gold cloaks waiting at the foot of the steps.
I am protecting your wretched bastard as well as I can, Cersei, he thought bitterly. See you do the same for Alla Yaya.
No sooner was Joff off than a runner came panting up the steps.
My lord, hurry! He threw himself to one knee. They've landed men on the tourney grounds. Hundreds. They're bringing a ram up to the king's gate.
Tyrion cursed and made for the steps with a rolling waddle. Podrick Payne waited below with their horses. They galloped off down River Row, Pod and Sir Mandon Moore coming hard behind. The shuttered houses were steeped in green shadow, but there was no traffic to get in their way.
Tyrion had commanded that the streets be kept clear so the defenders could move quickly from one gate to the next. Even so, by the time they reached the King's Gate, he could hear a booming crash of wood on wood that told him the battering ram had been brought into play. The groaning of the great hinges sounded like the moans of a dying giant. The gatehouse square was littered with the wounded, but he saw lines of horses as well, not all of them hurt, and sellswords and gold cloaks enough to form a strong column. "Form up!" he shouted as he leapt to the ground. The gate moved under the impact of another blow. "Who commands here? You're going out."
"No."
A shadow detached itself from the shadow of the wall to become a tall man in dark grey armor. Sandor Clegane wrenched off his helm with both hands and let it fall to the ground. The steel was scorched and dented. The left ear of the snarling hound sheared off. A gash above one eye had sent a wash of blood down across the hound's old burn scars, masking half his face. "Yes?" Tyrion faced him. Clegane's breath came ragged.
"Bugger that. And you."
A sellsword stepped up beside him. "We've been out 3 times. Half our men are killed or hurt. Wildfire bursting all around us. Horses screaming like men and men like horses. Do you think we are due to fight in a tourney? Shall I bring you a nice iced milk and a bowl of raspberries? No? Then get on your fucking horse. You too, dog." The blood on Clegane's face glistened red, but his eyes showed white. He drew his longsword. "He is afraid," Tyrion realized, shocked.
"The hound is frightened."
He tried to explain their need.
"They've taken a ram to the gate. You can hear them. We need to disperse them."
"Open the gates. When they rush inside, surround them and kill them."
The hound thrust the point of his longsword into the ground and leaned upon the pommel, swaying.
"I've lost half my men. Horse as well. I'm not taking more into that fire."
Sir Mandon Moore moved to Tyrion's side, immaculate in his enameled white plate.
"The king's hand commands you. Bugger the king's hand."
Where the hound's face was not sticky with blood, it was pale as milk.
"Someone, bring me a drink."
A gold cloak officer handed him a cup. Clegane took a swallow, spit it out, flung the cup away.
"Water? Fuck your water. Bring me wine."
"He is dead on his feet." Tyrion could see it now. "The wound. The fire. He's done. I need to find someone else. But who?
Sir Mandon?"
He looked at the men and knew it would not do. Clegane's fear had shaken them. Without a leader, they would refuse as well. And Sir Mandon? "A dangerous man," Jaime said.
"Yes.
But not a man other men would follow." In the distance, Tyrion heard another great crash. Above the walls, the darkening sky was awash with sheets of green and orange light. How long could the gate hold?
"This is madness," he thought. "But sooner madness than defeat. Defeat is death and shame."
"Very well, I'll lead the sortie."
If he thought that would shame the hound back to valor, he was wrong. Clegane only laughed.
"You?"
Tyrion could see the disbelief on their faces.
"Me?"
"Sir Mandon, you'll bear the king's banner. Pod, my helm."
The boy ran to obey. The hound leaned on that notched and blood-streaked sword and looked at him with those wide, white eyes. Sir Mandon helped Tyrion mount up again.
"Form up!" he shouted.
His big red stallion wore crinet and chamfron. Crimson silk draped his hindquarters over a coat of mail. The high saddle was gilded. Podrick Payne handed up helm and shield, heavy oak emblazoned with a golden hand on red, surrounded by small golden lions. He walked his horse in a circle, looking at the little force of men. Only a handful had responded to his command, no more than 20. They sat their horses with eyes as white as the hound's. He looked contemptuously at the others, the knights and sellswords who had ridden with Clegane.
"They say I'm half a man," he said.
What does that make the lot of you?
That shamed them well enough. A knight mounted, helmetless, and rode to join the others. A pair of sellswords followed, then more. The King's Gate shuddered again. In a few moments, the size of Tyrion's command had doubled. He had them trapped. If I fight, they must do the same, or they are less than dwarfs.
You won't hear me shout out Joffrey's name, he told them. You won't hear me yell for Casterly Rock either. This is your city Stannis means to sack, and that's your gate he's bringing down. So come with me and kill the son of a bitch.
Tyrion unsheathed his axe, wheeled the stallion around, and trotted toward the sally port. He thought they were following, but never dared to look. Sansa. The torches shimmered brightly against the hammered metal of the wall sconces, filling the Queen's ballroom with silvery light. Yet there was still darkness in that hall. Sansa could see it in the pale eyes of Sir Ilyan Payne, who stood by the back door, still as stone, taking neither food nor wine. She could hear it in Lord Giles' racking cough and the whispered voice of Osney Kettleblack when he slipped in to bring Cersei the tidings. Sansa was finishing her broth when he came the first time, entering through the back. She glimpsed him talking to his brother, Osfrid. Then he climbed the dais and knelt beside the high seat, smelling of horse. Four long, thin scratches on his cheek crusted with scabs, his hair falling down past his collar and into his eyes. For all his whispering, Sansa could not help but hear.
The fleets are locked in battle. Some archers got ashore, but the hounds cut them to pieces, Your Grace. Your brother's raising his chain. I heard the signal. Some drunkards, down to Flea Bottom, are smashing doors and climbing through windows. Lord Bywater sent the gold cloaks to deal with them. Baelor Sept is jam full. Everyone praying.
And my son?
The king went to Baelor's to get the High Septon's blessing. Now he's walking the walls with a hand, telling the men to be brave, lifting their spirits, as it were.
Cersei beckoned to her page for another cup of wine, a golden vintage from the arbor, fruity and rich. The queen was drinking heavily, but the wine only seemed to make her more beautiful. Her cheeks were flushed, and her eyes had a bright, feverish heat to them as she looked down over the hall. Eyes of wildfire, Sansa thought. Musicians played, jugglers juggled. Moonboy lurched about the hall on stilts, making mock of everyone, while Sir Dontus chased serving girls on his broomstick horse. The guests laughed, but it was a joyless laughter, the sort of laughter that can turn into sobbing in half a heartbeat. Their bodies are here, but their thoughts are on the city walls, and their hearts as well. After the broth came a salad of apples, nuts, and raisins. At any other time, it might have made a tasty dish, but tonight all the food was flavored with fear. Sansa was not the only one in the hall without an appetite. Lord Giles was coughing more than he was eating. Lolly Stokeworth sat hunched and shivering, and the young bride of one of Sir Lancel's knights began to weep uncontrollably. The queen commanded Maester Franken to put her to bed with a cup of dream wine. Tears, she said scornfully to Sansa, as the woman was led from the hall. The woman's weapon, my lady mother used to call them. The man's weapon is a sword. And that tells us all you need to know, doesn't it? Men must be very brave, though, said Sansa, to ride out and face swords and axes, everyone trying to kill you. Jaime told me once that he only feels truly alive in battle and in bed. She lifted her cup and took a long swallow. Her salad was untouched. I would sooner face any number of swords than sit helpless like this, pretending to enjoy the company of this flock of frightened hens. You ask them here, Your Grace. Certain things are expected of a queen. They will be expected of you, should you ever wed Joffrey. Best learn. The queen studied the wives, daughters, and mothers who filled the benches. Of themselves, the hens are nothing. But their cocks are important for one reason or another, and some may survive this battle. So it behooves me to give their women my protection. If my wretched dwarf of a brother should somehow manage to prevail, they will return to their husbands and fathers full of tales about how brave I was, how my courage inspired them and lifted their spirits, how I never doubted our victory even for a moment. And if the castle should fall? You'd like that, wouldn't you? Cersei did not wait for a denial. If I'm not betrayed by my own guards, I may be able to hold here for a time. Then I can go to the walls and offer to yield to Lord Stannis in person. That will spare us the worst. But if Maegor's holdfast should fall before Stannis can come up, why then, most of my guests are in for a bit of rape, I'd say. And you should never rule out mutilation, torture, and murder at times like this. Sansa was horrified. These are women, unarmed and gently born. Their birth protects them, Cersei admitted, though not as much as you'd think. Each one's worth a good ransom. But after the madness of battle, soldiers seem to want flesh more than coin. Even so, a golden shield is better than none. Out in the streets, the women won't be treated near as tenderly, nor will our servants. Pretty things like that serving wench of Lady Tander's could be in for a lively night. But don't imagine the old and the infirm and the ugly will be spared. Enough drink will make blind washerwomen and reeking pig girls seem as comely as you, sweetling. Me? Try not to sound so like a mouse, Sansa. You're a woman now, remember? And betrothed to my firstborn. The queen sipped at her wine. Were it anyone else outside the gates, I might hope to beguile him. But this is Stannis Baratheon. I'd have a better chance of seducing his horse. She noticed the look on Sansa's face and laughed. Have I shocked you, my lady? She leaned close. You little fool. Tears are not a woman's only weapon. You've got another one between your legs, and you'd best learn to use it. You'll find men use their swords freely enough. Both kinds of swords. Sansa was spared the need to reply when two kettleblacks re-entered the hall. Sir Osmond and his brothers had become great favorites about the castle. They were always ready with a smile and a jest. They got on with grooms and huntsmen as well as they did with knights and squires. With the serving wenches, they got on best of all, it was gossiped. Of late, Sir Osmond had taken Sandor Clegane's place by Joffrey's side, and Sansa had heard the women at the washing well saying he was as strong as the hound, only younger and faster. If that were so, she wondered why she had never once heard of these kettleblacks before Sir Osmond was named to the King's Guard. Osney was all smiles as he knelt beside the Queen. The hulks have gone up, Your Grace. The whole black water awash with wildfire. 100 ships burning, maybe more. And my son? He's at the mud gate, with the hand and the king's guard, Your Grace. He spoke to the archers on the hoardings before and gave them a few tips on handling a crossbow he did. All agree he's a right brave boy. He'd best remain a right live boy. Cersei turned to his brother Osfrid, who was taller, sterner, and wore a drooping black moustache. Yes? Osfrid had donned a steel half-helm over his long black hair, and the look on his face was grim. Your Grace, he said quietly. The boys caught a groom and two maidservants trying to sneak out a postern with three of the king's horses. The knight's first traitors, the queen said, but not the last, I fear. Have Sir Ilion see to them and put their heads on pikes outside the stables as a warning. As they left, she turned to Sansa. Another lesson you should learn, if you hope to sit beside my son. Be gentle on a night like this, and you'll have treasons popping up all around you like mushrooms after a hard rain. The only way to keep your people loyal is to make certain they fear you more than they do the enemy. I will remember, Your Grace, said Sansa, though she had always heard that love was a surer route to the people's loyalty than fear. If I'm ever a queen, I will make them love me. Crab claw pies followed the salad. Then came mutton, roasted with leeks and carrots, served in trenches of hollowed bread. Lollies ate too fast, got sick, and retched all over herself and her sister. Lord Giles coughed, drank, and passed out. The Queen gazed down in disgust to where he sprawled with his face in his trencher and his hand in a puddle of wine. The guards must have been mad to waste manhood on the likes of him, and I must have been mad to demand his release. Osfried Kettleback returned, crimson cloak swirling.
There's folks gathered in the square, Your Grace, asking to take refuge in the castle. Not a mob, rich merchants and the like.
Command them to return to their homes, the Queen said. If they won't go, have our crossbowmen kill a few. No sorties. I won't have the gates open for any reason.
As you command.
He bowed and moved off. The Queen's face was hard and angry. Would that I could take a sword to their necks myself. Her voice was starting to slur.
When we were little, Jamie and I were so much alike that even our Lord Father could not tell us apart. Sometimes, as a lark, we would dress in each other's clothes and spend a whole day each as the other.
Yet even so, when Jamie was given his first sword, there was none for me.
What do I get?
I remember asking.
We were so much alike. I can never understand why they treated us differently. Jamie learned to fight with sword and lance and mace, while I was taught to smile and sing and please. He was heir to Castle Rock, while I was to be sold to some stranger like a horse, to be ridden whenever my new owner liked, beaten whenever he liked, and cast aside in time for a younger filly. Jamie's lot was to be glory and power, while mine was birth and moonblood.
But you were queen of all the seven kingdoms, Sansa said.
When it comes to swords, a queen is only a woman after all.
Cersei's wine cup was empty. The page moved to fill it up again, but she turned it over and shook her head.
No more. I must keep a clear head.
The last course was goat cheese served with baked apples. The scent of cinnamon filled the hall as Osney Kettleblack slipped in to kneel once more between them.
Your Grace, he murmured, Stannis has landed men on the tawny grounds, and there's more coming across. The Mudgate's under attack, and they brought a ram to the King's Gate. The imp's gone out to drive them off.
Well, that will fill them with fear, the Queen said dryly. He hasn't taken Joff, I hope.
No, Your Grace. The King's with my brother at the Hawes, flinging antler men into the river.
With the Mudgate under assault? Folly. Tell Sir Osmond I want him out of there at once. It's too dangerous. Fetch him back to the castle.
The imp said, it's what I say that ought to concern you.
Cersei's eyes narrowed.
Your brother will do as he's told, or I'll see to it that he leads the next sortie himself, and you'll go with him.
After the meal had been cleared away, many of the guests asked leave to go to the sept. Cersei graciously granted their request. Lady Tanda and her daughters were among those who fled. For those who remained, a singer was brought forth to fill the hall with the sweet music of the high harp. He sang of Jonquil and Florian, of Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, and his love for his brother's queen, of Nymeria's 10,000 ships. They were beautiful songs, but terribly sad. Several of the women began to weep, and Sansa felt her own eyes growing moist.
Very good, dear. The Queen leaned closer. You want to practice those tears? You'll need them for King's Tennis.
Sansa shifted nervously. Your Grace?
Oh, spare me your hollow courtesies. Matters must have reached a desperate strait out there if they need a dwarf to lead them, so you might as well take off your mask. I know all about your little treasons in the Godswood.
The Godswood?
Don't look at Sir Dantas. Don't.
Sansa told herself.
She doesn't know. No one knows. Dantas promised me. My Florian would never fail me.
I've done no treasons. I only visit the Guardswood to pray.
For Stannis? Or your brother?
It's all the same.
Why else seek your father's gods?
You're praying for our defeat.
What would you call that, if not treason?
I pray for Joffrey. She insisted nervously.
Why?
because he treats you so sweetly.
The queen took a flagon of sweet plum wine from a passing serving girl and filled Sansa's cup.